my beautiful Woman Inc. listeners, welcome back. My guest this week is A. Mo. Mo is a seasoned startup co-founder and CEO of Boomerang with a decade of experience in bringing category-creating products to market. Boomerang, the most popular extension for Gmail and Outlook, enables millions of people to email more effectively with artificial intelligence. Mo is an innovator with multiple patents and just an incredibly recognized and successful entrepreneur. In her experience as chief product officer, Mo has grown her product line's revenue from zero to $50 million profitably on a $400,000 total investment. There are times when I just come across an interview where people just absolutely blow my mind. And that was my experience interviewing Mo. She is just so incredibly intelligent and well-seasoned. I learned so much from her. I can't wait for you guys to listen to this conversation. She brings so much knowledge and experience as a founder. Now, let's get on over to my conversation with Mo.
Welcome to the Woman Inc. podcast. This is the place for the new generation of women looking to lead the life of their absolute dreams. I'm your host, Jenna Toddy, entrepreneur, life coach, and strategist for modern businesswomen and entrepreneurs. I'm a city girl, sriracha lover, and that friend who will hype you up and forget how powerful you truly are. I am on a mission to make Woman Inc. the most powerful network.
Hello, Mo. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. Wait, we have to just quickly talk about your name because you just told me something and I wish we were recording, but talk about the Burmese. There's no last name.
Yeah. So I'm originally from Burma. That's where I was born and raised. And Burma actually is a matriarchal system. So women actually is the one that carries down the line. So if you get married, the men actually move into the woman's family's compound or whatever. So we don't actually have a patriarchal last name system. Everybody has their own personal name. And when you are born, you are given a full name and then you pick which part of your name that you prefer to go by in everyday life. So yeah, there's no, you know, so-and-so family, which is the man's last name that everybody has to kind of fall in line.
I love this. Okay, amazing. So I'm so excited to chat with you. I would love to start by going back and kind of chatting about what you studied and in the early days of your career, what you were working on.
So I came from Burma directly to MIT, which is quite a shock. And it was also my first flight ever. I have never taken a flight before, which was kind of its own story, right? So when I got there, I wasn't sure what I wanted to study. So I try out computer science, economics, and math. Those are the three that freshman year, I took all three to kind of taste, you know, how I felt and how I liked the subject. And then I decided that I was going to study computer science because I thought that would require me to talk to people the least. In some, my like, you know, 19-year-old freshman mind, I'm like, oh, I'm going to just code. Nobody's going to bother me. And also I wasn't that confident with, I never spoke English before. So I was like, oh, this way I'll just be, you know, be able to just do what I do best and not have to worry about my English or something, right? And then turn out this totally different position where now I'm the CEO of a software company. And all I do is talk to people in meetings all day.
And on podcasts.
And get on podcasts.
In your free time.
Yeah.
Amazing. Oh my gosh. Wow. I can't even imagine one. I just want to commend you because that is so brave. And I mean, your English is absolutely perfect, but I can't imagine moving to a new country where I don't know the language on my first flight. That's a next level bravery move.
I think when you don't know why you don't know and you're young, you're like, oh, why not? Right?
That is innocence is bliss.
Yes. It's like there's a certain level of ignorance that gets you, you know, when you look back, it looks like you're brave, but it's really, you don't know what you don't know.
It's so true. Okay. So how did you like MIT? Like how was the journey of coming to the US and going to MIT for you?
I finally found my place. This is, you know, Burma was, it's traditional ways, and there's a lot of emphasis on being obedient, especially for women. Even though it's a matriarchy, there is a lot of, you know, it's kind of a weird setup. Like women are expected to be professionals, right? If you say somebody is going to go see a surgeon, in your mind, you just assume that's a woman, because we have this really interesting system where we have the British education system because we were a former British colony. And when you graduate from high school, everybody take the same exact exam. The whole country take the same exact exam. And you get a ranking from your scores from the exam. So you get ranked from 1 through whatever, right? And when you apply to colleges, they try to impose, especially for medical school, which was the top school, they would impose 50-50 gender ratio. So if you are a woman, the cutoff score to go to the best college is 20% higher than if you're a man.
What?
Because they couldn't just pick the first 500 people, because then there would be too many women. And that would make it so that, like, when they do, so we still had a lot of wars in the edges of the country. And when you do the residency, you know, they felt like you couldn't send women into active war zones, and which is its own thing, right? So yeah, it's kind of like when I tell this story to Americans, they're just like, what are you talking about? This makes no sense. But so you would assume if somebody say, I'm going, you know, to see the top surgeon in this field, your assumption is it's a woman, right? But at the same time, women are supposed to be quiet and not loud and not be, you know, questioning authority, right? So as a student who was very curious and doesn't have very good filters, I did not have a great time throughout the primary to high school.
Yeah.
Because I was always like, oh, you said this and you said that and they don't match up. In my mind, I'm just thinking through and asking, but a lot of teachers thought I was questioning their authority or challenging. When I finally got to MIT, American system is totally different. You are supposed to ask questions. You are graded on class participation. So instead of being scolded for asking questions or raising my hand, I'm like, oh, this is how people are supposed to pursue knowledge, right?
Yeah.
And I was actually told at the beginning that, oh, I'm too quiet, I can't hear you. So, but then in my mind, I was like, oh, I have always been American. I finally found my place.
Where
it is not only okay, encouraged to ask questions.
Yeah.
So that was my adjustment. There's like a lot of, you know, there are things that I didn't know how to really navigate, but MIT had a great support system for international students, taking us out to go buy ski boots, snow boots and snow jackets. Cause a lot of us have never seen a lot of MIT, you know, international students. We never seen snow. This is our first time being in a place where you actually need a snow boot. So they were like, oh, let's go shopping. And, you know, they show us like, this is how you dress in the winter so your toes don't get frostbite.
I love that. That's so sweet that they do that. Do you feel like having that kind of edge of, I'm new here and I need to learn like the ways of life and everything is so exciting and new? Do you think that really brought you into entrepreneurship, where you felt like you were going to make a name for yourself?
So my parents were entrepreneurs and my mom and dad run the company together. So I just thought that's what people do. Most of my family, we are Chinese immigrants to Burma, and that has this all long history too. And a lot of my family are also like, they have their own businesses. So for me, it's like normal mode. But when I graduated from MIT, I was on student visa and there is no viable path for somebody on student visa to start a company. So I just go and, you know, interview a bunch of big companies that can support H-1B. And that was like, I can see that far out.
Yeah.
So it was never like, hey, I'm going to go start a company one day. I was just like, okay, I'm just doing one step at a time and kind of pursuing what will give me the most growth. And at the same time, my partner at the time, we met at MIT. So we were same major, same class, right? We'd done a bunch of projects together at school. And once we started dating, you know, we have no kids. We go to work, we come home. So we started building a bunch of site projects at night just because we wanted to build some stuff. So we knew we can work together and like working on stuff together. And then he decided that he wants to start a company. And I was like, yeah, go do it, you know, because we don't have kids. We don't have mortgage. We just are done paying our student loans. Go for it. So he started the company with one of his former co-workers. And I was just helping them out because they were actually working at an electrical engineering company. And I was the one who's actually in the software field. So I help with a lot of, you know, hey, this is how you interview a software engineer, or this is how you set up something, right? So nights and weekends, I would work with them and then I go to my day job. And it just kept going for about probably almost a year. And then I realized this is a lot of fun. I want to do it for real. And at the same time, we needed to move from Boston to California to raise our funding. So that just kind of all came together. And then I talked to the two co-founders. Hey, we're all having fun. I'm moving from Boston to here instead of finding a new job and doing this, you know, startup thing on nights and weekend, why don't I join formally? So I actually joined when the company moved from Boston to California, quit my full-time job and joined them as the third co-founder.
And not only joined them, but now you're the CEO.
That's right. Yeah. So the first 10 years we work on email productivity. So making sure that all your emails are follow up, right? Making sure that email is put on your timeline instead of somebody else's timeline. Making sure you can write email optimally. So we actually did an AI email assistant in 2016, way ahead of what, you know, current AI boom. And we were a little bit too early in a sense because the models and what we can do wasn't as sophisticated as what you can get today. So we did a bunch of things that help people handle, manage, and control email better for yourself, right? And that was about the first 10 years or so. About 8.5 to 9 years in, I got pretty burned out. So I decided, hey, I'm going to take a year off, go figure out what I'm going to do next. I did a bunch of productivity consulting, which is, I'm a productivity geek at heart. So even though I was thinking about the next thing, I knew it was still going to be in productivity. So I was like, hey, let's just help people get more productive by helping them set up their own personal systems while I'm looking around for what to do. The other way I was looking for inspiration was to talk to lots of other startup founders and what they were doing. And the best way to do that was to become an angel investor. I also joined a VC firm for a couple months just as an advisor, you know, trying to learn the other side of the table. And so I was doing all those three, and doing that basically makes me meet 10 to 20 new people a week. And then when you're meeting 10 to 20 new people a week, you need a meeting scheduling solution because it gets pretty inefficient if you're just sending back email back and forth. How about Monday at 2, Tuesday at 5? And so I try out a bunch of tools on the market, you know, whatever was available and popular at the time. And I just felt like they weren't solving my problems. So I decided, hey, we have this technology that create this live clickable image in your email. And I was like, we can get a person's calendar, put it into a bookable image in the email. And this can solve a lot of the problems that we are seeing. Because the main problem with the scheduling links were I didn't feel good about sending them. You know, there's an element of power dynamics. I think especially women and people of color tend to notice it more than I think white men do.
Yeah.
And it's also like when you talk to the VC, they're like, oh, of course, it's so convenient. Everybody clicks it and does the work. So easy. And it's easy for you, the sender, not the recipient. The recipient kind of feels like crap when you get sent a link. So I was like, hey, let's make it actually respectful for both sides. Because meeting scheduling is a lot of the time how you're setting your first impression and the foundation of the relationship. You don't want it to have this kind of a howdy, you know, oh, I'm just sending you a link and you go figure out how to schedule this meeting, right? So I was like, we really want to make it so that it's really easy and efficient for the sender, but not disrespectful to the recipient and make that experience on the other end as smooth. It feels like a person just making it easy for you, rather than, hey, you're not important enough for me to actually schedule something.
Yeah, so interesting.
Yeah, so when I started thinking about that and trying to agitate within the company, like, we got to build this, my co-founder and the former CEO was like, that's not my thing. I don't, he didn't want to work on that. And he's, well, if you want to work on this part and, you know, move the company to that way. And the other part is we realized that the go-to-market for meeting scheduling is going to be more towards teams and enterprises rather than the self-serve individual users. So we realized we need to do more of the pivot to the B2B side too. And he's like, my heart is not in it. If you want to do it, you take over. Then we can do it. So I stepped into the CEO role about a year ago.
Wow. And how is it going? How is the transition to CEO?
Interesting. At the beginning, you know, I used to say that my former job where you're the co-founder, but not the CEO, so that was the best job in the world because you have a lot of input. You have a lot of sway in the company direction and a lot of big responsibility. But ultimately, it's not, the buck didn't stop with you, right? You have always been like, oh, that's, he decided this or he decided that. Now is my show and I felt a lot more responsible for whatever we're doing, the direction, the pacing. So I think it's tougher. And I now understand why it's a little bit harder to sleep as the CEO than a co-founder.
Oh, yes. I can very much relate to that.
What's your experience?
Well, I was the president of a company and now I'm building a new company as CEO and I have a co-founder. So we're in full building stage.
But you see what I'm talking about. Yeah.
I know. My co-founder always jokes that he's my personal assistant. And I'm like, I'm gonna be your personal assistant. This is a lot of work. Okay, so this is exciting. So you get into this role as CEO and the product itself, so you're using AI to create email solutions, correct? Within the inbox.
We have some parts of it that have AI component and we just did a hackathon with the team about 2 weeks ago and we just did a demo day yesterday to layer in a lot of the things that we can leverage AI into what we already do. Because a lot of our things were a little bit more manual in the sense that the user kind of have to dictate the software, what exactly they want. But now that we have better technology, there are a lot of things that we can contextually provide the user's recommendation.
Got it. Okay. And how big is your team at Boomerang?
Right now we are 18 people. So it's kind of interesting. Like we have grown to over 30 people. And then we had Google and Microsoft copy some of our primary features. So that does, you know, put a dump on our both the morale and like how we wanted to grow the company. And we wanted to kind of get back to the basic and like figure out where the path is and where we want to invent and where we want to grow next. So we actually cut the team down to pretty small team. And then this last year has been the first year we are regrowing and hiring.
What you just said, I think, carries a lot of weight, especially in your world where these titans have manpower to not innovate, but to create very quickly, right? So how do you protect yourself from that?
One part that I didn't mention, we only raised $400K in the life of the company.
Wow.
That was back in 2011.
Million, right?
We are at 8 million ARR.
Wow. That's incredible.
So we grew with our own customer revenue. We are a profitable company before, you know, it now became kind of fashionable. We've been profitable for the last 9 years. And we've been fortunate enough to be in that position, right? So before, when we started, we have very little money, didn't have resources, and we were all first-time founders. So we didn't really understand the patent protection and all the other things that we were supposed to do. So we just build it, push it out there. And when things started to get copy from smaller companies, we didn't know that you were supposed to defend your IP, right? So everything just kind of snowballed from there. But our later features and later products that we've created since then, we have patent protection. And we intend to pursue, hey, if you actually start to infringe our patent, we actually have current pursuit. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, somebody who is violating one of our later patents.
Good. And I saw you have multiple patents that you own.
We do.
Mm-hmm. Great. Okay, good. These are the things you only learn by failing and going through pain.
I think so. I think this is, you know, you learn and it didn't kill you, so you survive and you do better the next time.
Yes. How do you feel? Like, because you mentioned in the beginning of our call that you are generally someone that's, you didn't want to be in front of people, right? And now you're a CEO. How do you feel like you've been able to become this person who can speak in front of people and lead a company of this size? What skills did you have to develop to become this woman?
I think a lot of it was just understanding over time that nobody actually knew everything, right? When you started as a first-time founder, you're like, oh, I don't know anything, but all these adults or all these other people knew what they were doing. And then as we start growing and like solving problems, and every time you're doing something new that you didn't know before, you learn and you got through it. You're like, oh, this is how everybody else is getting. And then you started having founder friends. You started having talking to people there where you're like, oh, I see. Nobody is, you know, magically like born knowing everything. Everybody's figuring out as they're going along. And it's important for me to be sharing my story so that other people will also realize, hey, nobody knew everything.
Yeah, it's such a powerful shift. I've had that shift.
Yeah.
Completely. This feeling of you walk in the room and you're like, I'm the one who doesn't know what's going on here. And then you're like, no one knows what's going on here.
Exactly.
I love this. Okay. So now that you're, how many years in are you on Boomerang?
We're 12, 13 years in.
Okay. 13 years in. 2 years as CEO.
Mm-hmm.
What is next? What are you most excited about?
Now we're learning how to do enterprise sales, which is, we got to where we are without a sales team, which is, you know, in its own story too, right? And the product-led growth that people have been talking about, that's what we've been doing. Now we're, you know, maturing as a company into a different go-to-market in the sense that we have been selling to individual self-serve audience forever. Now we're learning, how do I get our product into a team? How do I get our product into an organization? How does the selling process work? So we just hire a sales coach, learning that part of the B2B enterprise sales side of thing that a lot of companies kind of started with. And now we're like, it's going right now, which is interesting. I'm hiring a VP of marketing to kind of support all these functions that we're building up. So a lot of things that the company hasn't done before, which may seem trivial to other people, for us is, whoa, how does anybody do that? Let me learn. So I'm reading, learning, getting coaches. So a lot of growth going on, both for the company, you know, in terms of headcount functions and personal learning and growth for myself too, because I'm doing all of these for the first time too.
Yeah, that's so interesting. You're going backwards.
Yes.
At first sale, that's how it probably should be though. Do you still angel invest?
I am a little bit slowing down, mainly because I don't have as much time to talk to the founders.
Yeah.
But my deal flow is still there. I am part of an angels group called Angels.VC. It's a group of women who've just started informally gathering in San Francisco for, you know, dinners and drinks. To now, we kind of have a little bit of a group. We don't officially write the same checks at all the same time, but people bring in deals, we share with each other. And then I rely on a few people to like, hey, if they really tag me and say, hey, Mo, you should look at this. Those are the ones that I pay attention to, but I can't, since I can't talk to every founder who wants to talk to me right now.
Yeah, that's great. For anyone listening who's about to raise and they're in that process of building a business, what do you look for when you've invested in a founder? What is something that you think is really important?
I think in the business itself, I'm looking for, how does this product, service, technology impact the world at large? I only invest in things that I believe should exist in the world. And then the other part is the founders. I don't know that it's the best investing thesis or strategy, but I really enjoy talking to founders and get excited when they are really mission aligned, right? They want to, and they come from the place of, I want this thing to exist in the world more than I want to make a lot of money, or, hey, I'm a founder looking for a company to build. So they tend to be pretty focused. They may have pivots within the mission that they set out to, but typically not founders who are like, oh, I tried this gaming company and then this crypto company, and now they are doing this clean tech, like where you can kind of see they're just looking for a company to build rather than I want this thing to exist in the world. And that's typically what I dig into when I talk to the founders. Like, why this company? Why this product? What have you thought about? And kind of like, how did you get to where you are? What are the pivotal decision-making process in your life journey? And that's what I really look at, because I think that's the type of the founder that I am. Like, I want to build things that I want to see in the world. And I think those founders typically don't give up easily, because to them, that thing not existing is an affront. Right? It's like a personally insulted that this doesn't exist. And that gives you a lot of drive and resilience when things don't go perfectly, right? As a founder, you know, like there's ups and downs, and it's easy to be motivated or motivating to your employees when things are going well. But when things are not going perfect, where are you going to draw the source of energy?
Yes. Oof, that's good. The source of energy is important. It's an important well to be able to pull from, because I think what you're saying is so right on. And so many founders that are going into these meetings with VCs or family office or whatever it is, they are so focused, I think, on being told, like, show me the path to profitability, and show me your margins, and show me your expenses, and all, right? But those things are so trivial if you don't have mission. And if you don't have mission, I think you're kind of screwed when you have a bad year or a bad quarter, because the energy fades.
Yes.
I love that advice. That's great. On a personal level, as CEO and someone who's super busy and running this incredible company, how do you feel like you are able to take time for yourself and really come back into your power?
I have two major things that I put into my daily habit. One is doing yoga before work. And it's just, I don't do anything fancy. It's just like I put on a YouTube video and, you know, I have a yoga mat next to my desk and that's it, right? And then my lunch hour is sacred. I do not book meetings. Every lunch hour is completely protected, and I eat the first 30 minutes, and then the next 30 minutes I take a walk. We have a neighborhood park that's beautiful. It's like when you walk in, it just feels like you're in this absolute jungle, and I get this green forest therapy every day for 30 minutes. And then come back. So those are the two things that I make it non-negotiable. Maybe like when I'm in a conference or, you know, special stuff, but that's not that many days. But every single workday, those are the two things I protect. I think that's the only two sustainable thing I can do. The rest is taken up by kids and family and work.
Where do you live? Where's this magical?
I'm in Berkeley.
Oh, you're in Berkeley.
Yeah, I'm on the Berkeley Hill. So we have a lot of litter parks and jungly areas. And even the neighborhood itself is so lush and green. So.
Oh, that's so nice. Mo, thank you so much. I have one final question for you, which is, what would be your number one piece of advice for a woman starting her own business?
Ooh, I think it's maybe two-part. Make sure you're doing it for the right reason. So there are a lot of things that women are supposed to do because you're expected to. There is a lot of expectations and obligation put onto you by society, parents, friends, family, right? Hey, you went to MIT, you're supposed to be having this kind of jobs, right? There are a lot of expectations that people put, and you don't necessarily know, are you doing it because you want to? Or are you doing it because that's what general life path that you think is supposed to be? So that's the main thing. And then once you have that figured out, just keep going. So there are a lot of things that are going to be in our way. We couldn't raise funding in Boston. And then when we got here, we're like, oh, now we have some seed round. They're like, oh no, this product, nobody's going to pay for it. Everybody will tell you things that you can just listen to naysayers as you go along, because they don't know what you know. They don't know what you're trying to build. and it's a lot easier to be a critique than a creator, right? So as the creators, as somebody who is trying to forge a path, you'll see obstacles and just keep going. But you need the reasons, the right reasons for you to keep going. Because if you're doing it for the wrong reason, and when things come up, it will be clear. You're like, oh, that's right. Why am I doing this?
Yes. Oh, so good. Thank you so much.
Okay, I hope you enjoyed this episode and are feeling so fired up to go out there and create that business or side hustle that's been on your to-do list, you know, a little bit longer than you care to admit. It is never too late to make the first step towards the life you want more than anything else. If you haven't already, make sure you are subscribed to the show so that you never miss an episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. Until next time, keep becoming the woman of your wildest dreams.